Okay, so it's been a tough year for Hillary Swank and for certain dictators and a lot of other people, frankly. But all this week we've been profiling companies, medical advances, other things that had a banner year. And now Robert Smith of NPR's Planet Money team reports it's been a good year for a certain beverage, coconut water.
A couple of years ago, if you wanted to drink coconut water, you had to buy your own coconut, bring it to your kitchen, find a knife you didn't mind destroying, and start whacking. Not going to happen. Luckily, though, 2011 means you can now find packaged coconut water in a convenience store, at Walmart, or your friendly neighborhood yoga studio.
I think it was a great year for coconut water. I can't walk down the street without seeing someone with coconut water in their hand.
Alejandra Simon is an assistant manager at the Laughing Lotus Yoga Studio in New York City. And if you want to know how coconut water pulled off the marketing miracle this year, you have to come to a place like this. Laughing Lotus does not sell sports drinks.
We wouldn't dare stack Gatorade or Powerade or any of those really like fake drinks.
They only have coconut water. It's more expensive than Gatorade, sure, but it's pure, straight from the coconut into the package. And Simon says it does seem to hydrate her customers after a long yoga session. But coconut water also projects a certain vibe.
If people see me carrying around this coconut water with my yoga mat, they're going to know that I like yoga and I'm really conscious and enlightened.
Sure, it is easy to laugh at coconut water and call it another health food fad like pomegranate juice or green tea and everything. But beverage consultant Tom Perko says in 2011, coconut water worked.
Some of the brands are up 400% in 1 year. It's a phenomenon.
And Perko says it really isn't about what's inside the package. Coconut water has a fine taste. It's a little bit sweet, a little bit sour, plenty of potassium. But in the beverage business,
the only thing that really counts is image.
And coconut water nailed it. Among a certain demographic, soda seems like sugary poison. Even fruit juices are packed with calories, but coconuts evoke healthy people relaxing on a beach, the perfect antidote to 2011.
People are feeling poorly about what is going on in their lives, in our country. There's a great deal of anxiety. And they're looking for things that somehow give them, if not an edge in terms of how they perform, but something that makes them feel good.
And although the business is still tiny compared to soda, it is lucrative. The industry leader, Vita Coco, will do close to $100 million in sales this year. Pretty good for a beverage that Mike Kurban started to import in 2004. Kurban hustled Vita Coco to stores in his Brooklyn neighborhood.
You know, it was literally, I'm selling coconut water. Coconut what? Coconut water. You mean coconut milk? No. Very different. So there was a lot of education.
Hence the push to yoga studios. Then celebrities started drinking it. Then the big beverage companies got in. Coca-Cola invested in Zico coconut water. Pepsi has stakes in two different brands. And Kurban is okay with this. One kind of coconut water makes it a novelty beverage in the health food aisle. But with a bunch of big players?
5 shelves of coconut water. 4 different brands in there, all different flavors. And it really helps build a category as opposed to a brand.
And pretty soon people forget that you can just make your own coconut water in the kitchen. Kurban has a suggestion for me.
The best way to open up a coconut, honestly, is with a drill.
Hey, that totally works. Coconut water comes right out. But until people start to bring power tools to their yoga classes, the packaged coconut water industry has very little to fear. Robert Smith, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering IRA savings products and a Raise Your Rate 4-year CD. Learn more at allybank.com.
This is NPR News.
A lot of critics, professional and amateur, have spent a lot of time in the last few weeks making best-of lists, movies, trends, gadgets, gaffes. TV critic Eric Deggans wants to note a trend, the triumph of funny women.
Is there anybody on TV more adorable than Zooey Deschanel on Fox's new hit sitcom, The New Girl?
So, you know in horror movies, when the girl's like, oh my God, there's something in the basement. Let me just run down there in my underwear and see what's going on in the dark. And you're like, what is your problem? Call the police. And she's like, okay, but it's too late because she's already getting murdered. Well, my story is kind of like that.
She's playing a woman who's moved in with three guys after a bad romance. We've seen Deschanel play this character countless times over the last 10 years. Quirky, bohemian, earnest, and a little dorky. Fox even coined the term adorkable just to describe her. But she's also the leading edge of a trend that defined television in 2011, the funny female.
I believe paying no taxes can help us return to the America I love.
That's Saturday Night Live's Kristen Wiig playing GOP presidential candidate Michelle Bachmann.
The America of thousands of years ago in which feral bands of mud people lived in their caves, never worrying that Barack Obama was going to come and take their hard-earned pelts or infringe on their right to bear spears. That's my America.
Wiig practically defines the year of the funny female on TV. And not just because she dominated the funniest skits on SNL this year. It's also because Wiig's hit movie Bridesmaids gave a boost to two of television's other female MVPs of comedy, Mike and Molly star Melissa McCarthy and Maya Rudolph from NBC's Up All Night. When other TV shows tanked, Rudolph and Christina Applegate stepped up with their oddball chemistry as a daytime TV star and her executive producer pal, who's also a new mom.
Do not worry, I'm going to fire Nancy.
Yeah?
Yes, of course. I'm a firing machine, honey. That's why they call me the ray gun. Pew, pew, you're fired.
You used to be the ray gun, but since you've had Amy, you have lost your edge. Now you've been more like, ray gonna let everything slide.
When you consider who watches TV, this all makes sense. Women typically watch more TV than men, and outside of sports, shows with a high percentage of female viewers also tend to be among television's most successful. Think American Idol and Dancing with the Stars. Comic Whitney Cummings even grabbed two prime spots on the schedule as an executive producer on CBS's Monday night hit Two Broke Girls and star of NBC's Whitney.
I mean, being a comedian is not really a choice. It's just you either have a bad childhood or you don't. And thank you, Mom and Dad, for that.
In January, Cummings' NBC show will be paired with a new sitcom on the life of boozy, sexy comic Chelsea Handler.
You cannot date my ex-boyfriend. That is very slutty.
I would let you date one of my ex-boyfriends.
When am I going to call up Vinny Machado and see what time he gets off at the cigarette factory and then we can go down to the river and molest each other?
That's right. A double-barrel shot of in-your-face females happy to sling sex jokes just like the boys. It's debatable whether this is such a wonderful leap forward for female images. But just a few years ago, some critics predicted reality TV shows would kill the sitcom altogether. Instead, the rise of the funny female proves network TV's future likely comes with a smile and a pair of snappy high heels.
Eric Deggans is a TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. This is NPR News. Here in the U.S., car sales picked up this year, and dealers are hoping for a final burst of sales tomorrow. As NPR's Sonari Glinton reports, New Year's Eve may be the best day of the year to buy a new car.
If you watched any TV this holiday season, you've probably come across this commercial.
It's the most wonderful sale of the year.
That's typical around the end of the year, is to get those kinds of last-minute pushes for the last big sale of the year.
Aaron Bragman is an analyst with IHS Automotive.
Well, it's generally a good time for deals because a lot of people are already in a buying mood, and so automakers will come out with that added extra incentive to try and get people to shop not only for maybe Christmas presents, but also for potentially a new car as well.
Bragman says the end of the month is usually a good time to buy a car because dealers have to pay taxes on their inventory and they have to pay extra money to the car companies for those cars that stay on the lots.
The real reason is to try and get rid of inventory of the previous year. Nobody wants to try and buy a 2011 model year car in 2012. It's already considered last year's model.
Bragman says once the clock strikes 12, those new cars become last year's models, which is good for shoppers, not so good for dealers. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
A new film from Iran opens in theaters today. It deals with the subject of divorce, a sensitive topic everywhere, but especially so in Iran. The film's called A Separation. It's won awards all over the world, including 4 at the Berlin Film Festival. It was the New York Film Critics' Best Foreign Film of 2011. Howie Moshevitz of Colorado Public Radio talked to its writer and director about a story that goes beyond one family.
A Separation begins with a husband and wife explaining their differences to a judge. The wife is a modern woman who wants a modern life for herself and the couple's 11-year-old daughter outside of Iran. The husband says he wants to stay in the country to care for his Alzheimer's-stricken father. He also intends to keep custody of the daughter, which is customary in Iran. Asghar Farhadi wrote and directed the film.
The whole film is the explanation of a question that the judge asks. And the question is for the woman to answer. What are the conditions that you don't want to live here and you don't want to raise your children here? The film tries to give an explanation of the question that was asked by the judge.
The answer reaches into conflicts between the urban upper middle class and the working class, which in turn bring up opposing attitudes over religion and secularity, modernity and traditionalism.
Part of the people of the society think they want to adapt to modern life and they want to keep going with the flow, but another part thinks they want to retain the traditional identities of the past. This is a very natural phenomenon in any society that is about to leave the traditional lifestyle and enter modern life. It's dangerous when these two groups enter a war zone with each other instead of getting into dialogue.
After the couple separates, the husband hires a working-class woman from a traditional family to care for his father. She'll have to clean the old man, and the secular husband forgot that a traditional Muslim woman cannot touch a man to whom she's not related. So now she has to seek religious counseling, and the complications spin out of control. As a result, not everyone tells the truth. Hamid Nafisi, professor of film at Northwestern University and the author of a 4-volume history of Iranian cinema, says that's a pretty accurate reflection of Iranian society.
Publicly, people seem to abide, but privately, everybody is defying in one way or another all the rules and regulations. And I think Farhadi shows the human face of that, but also hints at the tragic consequences of it. And the way there's almost no way out of any situations, because every situation gets more complicated as you get deeper into it.
And the way the film looks reflects those complexities.
So the lighting is very dark, the curtains are drawn, the physical space is small, and then on top of that, the camera work is also very tight. Shot compositions are tight and emphasizing, re-emphasizing the spatial claustrophobia, which again, I think is sort of emphasizes again the kind of cauldron environment in which the whole family, the whole story is taking place. The whole society, I think, in a way, comes across as a very claustrophobic society.
Both Nafisi and filmmaker Asghar Farhadi agree that A Separation is more social observation than overt social criticism. The filmmaker walks a fine line in a country that's imprisoned artists and filmmakers, including the renowned director Jafar Panahi. But Farhadi says the Iranian government is more diverse than Americans think. Some officials tolerate his work, some don't. Farhadi compares it to driving a car.
I think when anyone steps into a car and decides to drive, they can't be sure whether or not they'll be safe. So far, I haven't had an accident.
But it's still good to know the rules of the road. For NPR News, I'm Howie Moshevitz.
We are going to stay on the topic of politics and take a closer look at a candidate whom supporters hope will be the breakout star of the Iowa caucuses. That is former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum. Recent polls show him surging into third place among the Republican presidential contenders. That's after months at the back of the pack. Among those converts to Santorum's camp is one particularly influential voice in Iowa politics, particularly on the Republican side. That is Bob Vanderplaats. He is the president and CEO of the Iowa-based organization called The Family Leader. It takes a conservative view of social issues, and he's back with us once again. Mr. Vanderplaats, thank you so much for joining us once again. Happy New Year to you.
Well, Michelle, Happy New Year to you and to your listeners, and thank you for having me on your program.
You know, when we last spoke in April, you had already been approached by every candidate then in the race, as I recall, and even some who had not made the decision to jump in. At the time we spoke, you said your goal was, and I do want to, this is a good point to place to point out that your endorsement is a personal one, right? It's your personal
endorsement,
not the organizational one. But at the time you said that the goal was have a level playing field, find out the candidate's core values and convictions, what's their vision for the country, and can they beat President Obama? So how did you personally decide that Rick Santorum was the guy who fit that bill?
Well, first of all, we're very sold on Rick Santorum with his core values, his convictions. We believe we can trust him. We believe he's a man of integrity. And even people who disagree with him about his conclusions on issues, they don't find him disagreeable. We also believe he has a great vision for this country. He was kind of Tea Party before Tea Party was cool. He was part of the Gang of Seven. And then can he beat Barack Obama? We have to look back at history. He defeated three incumbent Democrats on his way to become a congressman and then a U.S. senator. We believe Rick Santorum has what it takes not only to lead this country, but also to defeat Barack Obama and to carry our values into the White House.
But he also couldn't defend his own Senate seat.
Well, he couldn't defend his own Senate seat in the 2006 race, and he was the number one target by the Democrats. Pennsylvania is a fairly blue state. They saw Rick Santorum as a huge threat. And if you'll recall, Michelle, 2006 was a bad year for any Republican on the ticket, and especially when you're the number one target by the Democrats.
Well, and there's also been an interesting wrinkle to the story. We talked about the whole question of whether this is a personal or the endorsement of your organization. Since you've come out in support of Rick Santorum, there's been a lot of back and forth over whether you are trying to pressure other candidates, other socially conservative candidates to get out of the race and that's what. Now, you've said publicly you just think it's just common sense for people who share a certain skill set and values perspective to coalesce around one candidate. Could you just tell us, though, what do you think is going on, or how do you interpret all this anger around your decision to support Rick Santorum? In fact, I have to mention that Michelle Bachmann, for example, who had an early surge in Iowa, has said that you actually tried to pressure her to get out.
Well, you know, I can see some of the emotion around my endorsement of Rick Santorum, especially when you're not the one that I endorsed. However, we've been looking at this process for months. You talked about me being on your program back in April. A lot of us who have been sizing up this field, we've seen it for what it is that we are fragmenting our vote amongst many good pro-family conservative candidates. And if we continue to do that, the nominee or the person we're going to launch out of Iowa is going to be Governor Mitt Romney. We're kind of looking for that alternative to Romney. So it only makes sense for if there'd be a teaming or a coalescing. Now, I never called Michelle Bachmann to pressure her to get out of the race, but I did call Michelle Bachmann. I did call Rick Perry. I did call Rick Santorum. And I planted the seed about if we team, united we stand, but divided, I believe we're going to fall. And I said, that can't be a Bob Vanderplaats decision. That has to be a candidate-to-candidate decision. And I'm telling you, Michelle, that for people on the ground here in Iowa, if they saw a candidate lead that way to say, you know, this is about the cause of the country, it's not about me personally, this is about us winning not only the Iowa caucuses but the primary and then to beat Obama, I think you'd see people just rally around that.
However, that didn't happen.
And so what I did is I went out and I endorsed Rick Santorum. And I think what you're seeing right now is that conservatives are starting to coalesce on their own. They see Rick Santorum as the person who can win the Iowa caucuses, then go on to beat Romney and go on to beat Obama.
I do want to ask you a little bit about this, the quest to beat President Obama. Obviously, if you're a Republican, you want your team to win. But we had a conversation yesterday with Kevin Williamson of the conservative magazine, The National Review, and he described conservatives' feelings about the president this way. Here it is.
The real dynamic on the right now is between people who dislike Barack Obama and think his policies are wrong and people who hate Barack Obama and think that he's evil.
Why do they hate him?
Well, I think partly it's cultural, partly it's that he does pursue some pretty bad policies.
Well, what's your, and obviously you had a longer answer than that, but what's your take on that? I mean, do you really, is the issue here hatred for President Obama? What's your take on this?
Michelle, absolutely not. And I hope none of us are motivated by hate. And if, for those of us who call ourselves Christians, if we're motivated by hate, that's not a Christian value. Matter of fact, I happen to respect and admire President Obama and his wife, Michelle, for their marriage to one another, as well as being a great example of raising their two young daughters. That's where I respect and admire President Obama. where I have a disagreement with President Obama is in his policies. He's had a very mixed bag of policies as it relates to Israel. He won't defend the Defense of Marriage Act. He won't stand up for one man, one woman marriage, the universal health care. I just believe a lot of things are at risk in regards to our faith, our family, and our freedom under President Obama. It is not motivated by hate whatsoever. Matter of fact, I have great admiration for him breaking that race barrier, being our first African-American president. I think that's a very good thing. His family values that he demonstrates with his own family, I think it's a very good thing. It's the policy issues that we have disagreement on, not that we have hatred about. That's what I think makes America great, that we can discuss our disagreements, but it's not filled with hatred. I would never be about that.
And finally, before we let you go, and we only have a minute left, and I do hope we'll talk again
soon. I do want to.
The polls all show that while many people consider the social issues important, the economy really is foremost in many voters' minds. How does somebody like Rick Santorum, and we only have, I'm sorry, 45 seconds left on
sure.
this, distinguish himself on an issue like this?
Well, I think Rick Santorum has been very clear about the economy and limited government, and he ties it back to the family, that if we have strong marriages, we'll have strong families. If we have strong families, we can have limited government, and we also can have a thriving economy. But you have to get back to strong families first. And I think even fiscal conservatives, and I've studied economics and I've taught economics, they're starting to make that connection that social conservatism and fiscal conservatism have to walk hand in hand for the betterment of the future of this country.
That was Bob Vander Plaats. He is the president and CEO of the Iowa-based organization, The Family Leader. He joined us from Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. And, of course, Iowa moves into the national spotlight next week with the Iowa caucuses on January 3rd. Mr. Vander Plaats, thank you so much for joining us once again. Happy New Year to you.
Michelle, same to you. Thank you.